There are three issues before the court today. The first one deals with Mr. Bentley's rights to cross-examination and confrontation. These rights were violated below by the trial court when he was prohibited from questioning a very important witness in the state's case, Tina Creed, with respect to two complete lines of questioning regarding credibility. Those two lines of questioning included went to bias as well as a potential impaired ability to either perceive or remember the events that occurred. Ms. Creed, at the time of Mr. Bentley's trial, had pending drug charges, and her alleged co-conspirator was Arthur Bentley, also known as Joey. He is the uncle of my client, Jordan Bentley. The trial court was concerned about Ms. Creed's right against self-incrimination, and rightly so. However, the trial court, as a result of that concern, prohibited entire lines of questioning with regards to matters that did not involve her current drug charges. The Delaware Rule of Evidence 608B clearly states, additionally, that when dealing with credibility questioning, the testimony of a witness does not waive the right against self-incrimination. And the trial court, as well as the state, ignored that particular rule. And this court, as well as other courts, have noted that assertions of privilege by a witness may undermine the process to such a degree that meaningful cross-examination no longer exists. And that's what happened in this case. The court, as I mentioned, issued a blanket prohibition. With respect to bias, Mr. Bentley sought to question...
You're confusing me now.
I'm sorry.
We're talking about credibility, and now you're going into bias?
When I say credibility, I mean together her bias as well as her ability to perceive. The jury determining, I guess credibility is the wrong word, the jury determining her testimony. She gave several inconsistent statements here. When she first talked to the police, she did not implicate my client as the shooter. On her first day of, before trial, she told defense counsel that it was the other individual who was present, Buddy Pyle, who did the shooting. On her first day of testimony, she then stated that it was my client who did the shooting. Her second day of testimony, she said, I didn't see anybody, I didn't see which one did the shooting. So
what credibility was left at the end of her examination that you're claiming prejudice?
Well, I think the jury needed the tools before them to determine which of her statements was the truth. She was a very important witness in this case. There were three individuals who went to the shooting of Mr. Cox. My client put the finger on the other individual, Buddy Pyle. Buddy put the finger on my client. So she was extremely important. She wasn't implicated as the shooter at all. It's true that there are some credibility issues with respect to her change in stories, but the jury needed to understand why it changed the stories. For example, the state questioned Ms. Creed as to whether or not she still loved Jordan. And she said, yes, she had very strong feelings for him. The state then argued in closing that that was probably why she changed her story on cross-examination the second day. That demonstrates the importance of the line of questioning with regard to her relationship with Arthur Bentley that she was not allowed to ask at all. He was not allowed to ask. The trial court even noted that it was extremely relevant what her relationship with Arthur Bentley was, as well as her drug use. But because she wanted not to answer questions, he allowed her to invoke her right against self-incrimination. So Mr. Bentley could not rebut the state.
Are you contending that the trial judge was overbroad in terms of areas of Fifth Amendment protection, or are you saying that that was correctly applied, but the effect of which was to deny cross-examination?
I'm arguing two things. First of all, her right against self-incrimination didn't even apply in this case because the questions went to impeachment, and she doesn't waive her right against self-incrimination under 608B as a result of that. Secondly, assuming she did have that right, the court's ruling was overbroad and went to a blanket, it was a blanket prohibition. What should have happened in this case was the court should have had a voir dire with her outside the presence of the jury to ask her specifically questions and make a determination one by one as to whether or not she had a right against self-incrimination in that case.
Was that requested by counsel?
What happened with respect to counsel was he actually, that particular request I don't believe was made. What happened was he was asked to submit questions, specific questions, and Ms. Creed's attorney looked at him and said, she doesn't want to answer these because her sexual relationship with Mr. Bentley could somehow affect the fact that he's her co-conspirator in these pending drug charges. She doesn't want to answer questions about any potential drug use because that could somehow implicate her with respect to her pending drug charges.
And your point is that they should have been able to say, are you romantically involved with someone else, period, and you get the answer to that.
Yes.
And then preclude any questions about a co-conspiratorial relationship.
Correct. And, in fact, Mr. Bentley's attorney at trial said to the court, I'm willing to narrowly tailor these questions. And he did. He offered some questions with respect to the romantic involvement. And
are these questions in the record?
I believe no, because the questions, when they discussed them, the court simply looked at them. I'm not sure if it was an exhibit at court or not. Main thrust.
I saw the trial judge say they would be a court exhibit at some point. But you don't see them in the record?
I did not see them in the record, Your Honor. A lot of the questions.
How are we to evaluate whether there was prejudice from the denial of those questions if we don't know what they were?
Well, in the record, there is discussion with respect to the type of questions the attorney wanted to ask. In particular, with respect to the romantic relationship between Ms. Creed and Mr. Arthur Bentley, once the state opened the door on that, he said, I have a right to now ask her about this, and the court said no. And that was a later ruling by the court.
Did he make any proffer about what he anticipated he would ask and then what he anticipated the answer would be?
Yes, he wanted to ask her whether she was sexually involved with Arthur Bentley. There had been some letters back and forth between Miss Creed and her mother indicating that she was romantically involved with Arthur Bentley, thus leading to a good faith basis as to his asking the question. Originally, counsel was concerned about a potential motive that she had actually been a longtime girlfriend of my client. And at some point while he was incarcerated, she just stopped seeing him and started dating Arthur Bentley. And his assertion to the court was, well, this goes to a potential motive that she now wants Jordan Bentley in jail so she can continue seeing Arthur Bentley. Now, the state says that's a weak motive. It may be, but that's for the jury to determine. And coupled with that is the fact that the state then opened the door by suggesting she changed her story on the second day of trial because of her love for Jordan Bentley. So, essentially, she shouldn't have been permitted to invoke her right at all.
And the defense argument would be that she gave her story because of her love of Joey?
Yeah, for various reasons. She did. There was some cross-examination permitted. One was she was under the understanding
I'm
sorry.
The motive that the state was arguing for the change was the love of the defendant, right?
Correct.
And the defense theory was that which statement was because of her love for Joey?
Well, that wasn't necessarily what they were arguing. They were trying to undercut the motive for her changing her story. To say it wasn't necessarily.
The question is, what statement did she make in her testimony that supports the theory that she's changed her testimony in your client's favor?
Oh, the second, when she was cross-examined on her second day of testimony, which I think.
When she talked about the car blocking her view?
Exactly. She said, you know what, I went home after I testified on direct and I thought about it and I really didn't see who did the shooting. And my vision was blocked, that's why I didn't see it.
So the state would argue that she changed her story in that fashion in order to protect her boyfriend.
That's,
and you would have rebutted that by showing she's dating somebody else or romantically involved with somebody else, so that's baloney.
That's better put than I could put it.
Well, I could put it better.
Yes, that's exactly what the point was, and the state did, in fact, argue that to the jury. So, she, you know, there are several errors here. She shouldn't have been able to invoke her right. Even if she were, she was not entitled to say blanketly, I don't want to answer any questions. This court has found error and a violation of confrontation clause rights whenever an entire line of questioning has been shut down. In fact, in Delaware, State, Van Arsdale versus State, which was on remand from the United States Supreme Court. That's what this court held. Other cases included Weber versus State, and I believe Garden versus Sutton.
All right, well, let's go to the second line of inquiry, and that is whether she was under the influence of drugs. Did you simply want to say, were you under the influence of drugs, whether they were legal or not legal? And she would either say yes or no. And if there had been a carefully crafted question that just said, were you under the influence of drugs, and she either said yes or no, you would have accomplished what you wanted, whether they were illegal or not.
That's correct. That's half of it. I think what trial counsel also wanted to do, which was a little bit more probing, is as ask her, well, have you been using drugs over the last couple of years to determine whether or not she had an impaired memory? And I think that was important in this particular case as opposed to...
How would it have determined that? What was he prepared to offer to show that drug use of X kind over Y period of time would have impaired her memory?
I don't think he had any particular evidence to offer for that. I think an inference could have been drawn from the jury, by the jury. She had, and again, in letters to her mother...
Well, intuitively, that if you've been taking drugs over 2 or 3 years, you've impaired your memory?
That was what he wanted to argue to the jury.
No matter what the drug was or how many... milligrams or anything else?
Well, I think he was prepared to ask her about the type of drugs, and I believe according to...
Then it would have come out that they were illegal.
Correct. Now, my point, however, is even if it was illegal drug use, it still wouldn't implicate her right against self-incrimination with respect to the actual drug charges at issue. She had, again, this was for impeachment purposes, so she wouldn't have waived her right.
Charge that had been brought against her, is that in the record? Do we know, is a copy of the indictment, or is there some recital as to what period she was charged with, what period the conspiracy was? Is that in the record?
That indictment was not put in the record, and I do not believe that the court actually put that on the record as to what exactly the charges were.
Well, how do we evaluate? I mean, as I understood you, one of your arguments is that the trial judge was overbroad in his determination of what the scope of the Fifth Amendment privilege was.
Correct.
And how do we evaluate that without knowing what the charges
are? Well, I think what the record does demonstrate is they are drug sale-related charges. And I think that's completely different than drug use, which is what he wanted to get at. So
what was the time period of the charges? And what was the nature of the drugs? Is there anything in the record that will help us on that?
I do not believe so. I will double-check that. But I don't think there's a specific statement of what the charges were that were pending against her at that particular time. I do know that her attorney was called in. I think it was just an implied understanding that she had these charges and unfortunately wasn't put on the record. Again, the questioning went to her drug use, not to sale of drugs. I do believe that at least is supported by the record, that those are the charges. If you look at felony drug charges involving conspiracy, I think that would indicate that they were drug sales.
But wasn't there a general reference that she was charged with trafficking? I mean, didn't she acknowledge during her examination that she was charged with trafficking and other charges?
Yes.
Trafficking involves possession.
Correct. But it's not drug use. I mean, that's what it was, a general drug use question. And again, I go back to the rule of evidence 608B. Her right isn't even implicated in this case.
I don't understand how that works. 608B says if you're cross-examined, you're not waiving your right. But to the extent you give an affirmative answer, is there some rule that says it can't be used against you later? Or is it simply the fact that you answered a question that touched upon the subject doesn't constitute a waiver? You can't have a rule that creates an exception to a constitutional right.
Well, what I think is important here is, again, as the other courts in this court have found, if they were allowed to always invoke a privilege in these types of cases, there would never be, or not never,
but the question is, tell me how Rule 608B operates. You keep saying, well, you know, it just eliminates her right to invoke her privilege against self-incrimination because it's in the rule. But there's got to be more to it than that.
Well, if it's not a waiver against self-incrimination, I would imagine, although I did not see any cases to this effect, that could not be used against her later. There are federal cases that specifically dealt with this in stating that when an individual waives their right, when an individual testifies on cross-examination with respect to matters that normally would be subject to the right against self-incrimination, the trial court erred by not allowing the questioning. And that was the Tenth Circuit, United States versus Torres-Ortega, and also a United States Supreme Court.
I see you're in your rebuttal. I wanted to ask you about a different issue on appeal.
Yes.
That's the lesser included offenses. Is it? Does the record reflect the victim was shot four times?
Yes, it does. It does reflect that. However, as this court has held in Henry versus State, as long as there is some evidence to support manslaughter or the lesser included offense, it should be given. And in this case, there was such evidence.
But what was the point of entry of each gunshot wound? Were they all in it?
I think it was from above. I know there were some from above, and I think there may have been some
two,
from
above. Two were in the head, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And where were the other two?
That I don't recall. I believe they were definitely from a different direction. I think it was an angled direction, but it was definitely there were two to the head, which I know supports an intent on the part of the shooter.
Well, more importantly, you're getting down to about 3 minutes, but what is the precise evidence that would support the lesser included offense of manslaughter?
Well, a lot of Mr. Bentley's own testimony, and in Henry versus State, you know, the court may find that weak, but it is enough. Mr. Bentley testified that he was only a little angry about the ring, a little upset, actually, was his words, that he was under the impression they were going there for a physical altercation. Now, he denied even having a weapon, and he said Mr. Pyle was the one who had a weapon. He didn't know he had a weapon. Even if the court were to find or the jury were to find that he had the weapon, and he thought he was going there for a physical altercation to inflict serious physical injury, and maybe something got out of hand and with respect to the way that the shooting went in. Also, the words said at the scene was only the shooter said, "Did you buy a ring for that girl?" And he said, "Yes." And then the shooting supposedly ensued. So there was no words like, "I'm going to shoot you, kill you," etc.
And you think that's more consistent with manslaughter than it is with intentional murder?
Yes, I think that there is evidence. He said, "I thought we were going over there for a physical altercation, not a shooting." And Tina Creed, as well as Buddy Pyle, both testified, "We didn't think he was going to use the weapon when he went over there," if assuming they're correct.
But his defense was he didn't shoot it at all.
That's fine.
He fired at all.
That's fine. There can be inconsistent, lesser included instruction can be given even if he has an inconsistent defense. And I believe that's also been held by this court. Thank you.
Save the rest of your time for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely. I apologize to the court. I have a cold, and hopefully I won't start coughing, but I'll address the first two issues that have been discussed in oral argument this morning. If I may, I'd like to address the second issue first. I think it's probably a little simpler. That was whether or not there should have been a lesser-included jury instruction on the offense of manslaughter, lesser-included offense of intentional first-degree murder. The evidence in this case was simply insufficient for the court to give such a lesser-included instruction. The accused, Mr. Bentley's testimony, was not that he shot the victim, Mr. Cox, but that his cousin, Mr. Pyle, was the shooter. On the basis of that evidentiary record, someone else was the shooter, I didn't shoot anyone, there was simply no factual or legal basis for the court to give a lesser-included jury instruction on manslaughter.
Well, he could have asserted his innocence and said, but whoever shot the person committed it under circumstances that would have constituted a lesser-included offense. But in this case, he would have had to say, whoever fired four shots into the victim at point-blank range, two in the head, didn't commit first-degree murder. Yes. Is that right?
Well, I think so, and that's the other problem here, is that when you look at what actually occurred with the shooting, the victim was not shot once and under extreme emotional distress, which is normally what happens with manslaughter. To reduce an intentional homicide to manslaughter, the individual was shot four times. At least two of the shots were to the head. So I think on the basis of the evidentiary record that the trial judge had before him, there simply wasn't a sufficient basis to give the lesser included homicide instruction on manslaughter in this particular case.
On the first issue, do you know if the proposed questions are in the record anywhere?
I don't think they are. I didn't see those.
Is that because they were never given to the personatory and they weren't ever part of the record, or they're just not in anyone's appendix?
I'm not sure about that either, Your Honor. I have the two trial prosecutors here. I can ask them and inform the court. I don't know if it was a matter of simply not placing it before the court so that it could be made a court exhibit, or the fact that it's not in the appendix. It's certainly not in the state's appendix.
There were several questions of your colleague about what the charges were pending against Creed.
Yes.
Ms. Creed. Did the trial judge know what the actual charges were that were pending against her that gave rise to her assertion of her right not to incriminate herself?
I'm not sure if the trial judge knew all the charges. There were 12 offenses, is my understanding, one of which was a conspiracy allegation involving the accused's uncle, who was an alleged co-conspirator with Tina Creed. I think the most serious charge was a trafficking allegation, and there were other related charges. There may actually have been a firearm charge, too. I don't know if that was Tina Creed's possession or an imputed possession by Arthur Joey Bentley or not. That's, I think, as much as is in the record, that there were 12 charges. There was a trafficking charge, a conspiracy charge, and I believe there was mention of at least a firearm possession charge.
So we should assume that the trial judge was aware of that at the time of the ruling.
I would think the trial judge would at least know those three charges. Now, what the other 12 were, I don't know that those were ever specifically enumerated or laid out. And there was, however, questioning actually by the prosecutor in this case when Tina Creed was on the stand about the charges. She had been arrested approximately a month before the trial on these new charges, and the prosecutor asked her if she was facing pending criminal charges, and she acknowledged that she was, and he also asked her if she was looking at substantial potential jail time if she was convicted, and again she replied in the affirmative. So I think there was actually some evidence presented about this. What was done, however, as to the specific types of questions that the defense counsel wanted to ask, was that when the attorney for Tina Creed invoked her self-incrimination privilege, the judge had to then make a ruling, and he decided that as to asking her about the specific charges or prior drug use, that would be covered by the self-incrimination privilege.
Well, didn't one of the prosecutors, I think it may have been Mr. O'Neill, suggest that the judge should allow a question, were you under the influence of drugs at the time you observed the shooting? Wasn't that suggested by the state?
I think that may have been. And I'm not sure exactly why that wasn't asked, or that wasn't permitted to be asked. I guess the concern of the trial judge was that, well, once you start down that path, especially with a lay witness, you're never sure what they're going to say on the stand.
Isn't that the problem with a blanket prohibition that involves the invocation of the right against self-incrimination? Generally, as you know from other cases, you have specific questions and you invoke your right or you don't invoke it if you're not a co-defendant or you know, something like that. Here, it seems, if we go away from the drugs and just into the nature of the relationship with the uncle, it would have been possible to ask about a relationship with the uncle that had nothing to do with drugs.
Well,
and yet that wasn't done.
No, it wasn't done, and I think if anything, the prohibition may have been too broad, but ultimately I think it amounts to harmless error in this case, given the equivocal nature of the testimony that Tina Creed offered.
Okay, so if we remove from the record all the testimony of Tina Creed, what's left to convict the defendant?
Well, I think the testimony of the cousin, Buddy Pyle, who was an eyewitness there, that Mr. Cox was shot by Jordan Bentley. There was the testimony by the the uncle who was present. He was not sure exactly which one, but I think he said it was the one with the gun. And there's a testimony from a neighbor, a Ms. Harmon. She does not actually see the shooting itself, but what she does see and what she testified to at trial is the individuals leaving the back porch where the shooting occurred, going to the car, and she's able to identify Mr. Bentley as the individual with the gun. The other evidence that would point to the accused's guilt is the flight evidence in this particular case. He flees the scene of the shooting. There's also flight from the Pennsylvania police three or four days later when the all four of these individuals, Tina Creed, Mr. Pyle, Mr. Bentley, and Mr. Bentley's mother, are apprehended in western Pennsylvania by the Pennsylvania State Police.
When we look at the suggestion that it's harmless, one way to look at the state's case is that Ms. Creed was the tiebreaker in the testimony, so to speak, and the state liked her testimony the first day before she changed her mind. And what the defendant's saying is that if he would have been able to develop the cross-examination, for example, he would have been able to show that she was romantically involved with someone else and therefore was giving truthful testimony the second day rather than the first day, and it wasn't motivated by any continuing relationship with the defendant, all of which is relevant to the defense's assertion that if she's going to be the tie-breaking witness, cross-examination was important.
Well, I think for her to be the tie-breaking witness, she would have to have said that not Mr. Bentley was the shooter, but Mr. Pyle was the shooter. But she didn't say that, and that's why I don't think she's truly a tie-breaking witness. It's not, okay, this side, this number of witnesses say Mr. Pyle's the shooter, this side says Mr. Bentley's the shooter. Now, Mr. Bentley, in his own testimony, says that Mr. Pyle's the shooter, but no one else supports that. Ultimately, however, I think looking at the examination that was conducted and the questioning that was done, and given the equivocal nature of the testimony of Tina Creed, that any possible error by the trial court in unduly restricting bias or impeachment cross-examination here was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. This court does apply the harmless error analysis in these particular situations. This is a little unusual because the facts are pretty tangled up. You've got a witness who is actually offering equivocal testimony. One day she's testifying for the state, and next day she's supporting a defense version that's contrary to what she said on the witness stand the day before.
And the ultimate issue is, which day was she telling the truth, and what information is at hand for a jury to determine which day she was telling the truth? Her first testimony or second testimony, which was true? What do they have to work with to reconcile that inconsistency?
Well, they don't have a whole lot other than what the witness herself has said, and I don't know that there is any way to reconcile that other than to attribute one motive or another.
Arguably one way to reconcile it is to say, here are all the reasons why you should believe what she said the first time she testified. Here are all the reasons why you should believe, to the contrary, what she said the second time she testified. And unless the jury hears all of that, how do they reconcile the two? How do they determine which testimony was truthful and which was not?
Well,
it appears, at least superficially, that the court's ruling was there are reasons why you will not be able to hear all of the evidence that would assist you in determining which day's testimony was truthful. There are reasons for preventing the jury from hearing others, but they don't relate to the truth of the matter in the trial. They relate to something extraneous. What's your view, by the way, Justice Holland asked your colleague earlier, what's your view, by the way, of how Rule 608 should work?
Well, I've always been confused by 608, too.
But you're here to unconfuse us.
Well, hopefully I can be of some assistance to the court. I think the starting principle is that a rule of evidence can't trump a constitutional right, and a defendant certainly has a constitutional right against self-incrimination. The real difficulty, and I guess what the drafters were doing when they constructed this rule, because obviously I think they were aware of the self-incrimination problem, is trying to tailor it narrowly. The difficulty, though, when you have lay witnesses on the stand, once you start down that path, you're not sure what they're going to say and what they may blurt out. And I think the trial judge, he may have been overcautious in extending it as far as he did, but the tangled up nature of everything with the person she's romantically involved in now happens to be her co-conspirator in these pending charges, and I think that's what gave the trial judge pause and why he made as extensive a ruling as he did.
Could the state have solved all of this headache by granting or asking for use immunity for the witness?
Well, I don't know. They may have needed to ask for use and derivative use immunity, and I'm not sure that the state was prepared to do that at that point. I mean, a trafficking charge is usually a pretty serious drug charge. So I don't know all the dynamics. That may have been a possible solution, however. If there's any additional questions,
well,
I'll try to answer
those.
Just
on the last issue, this videotape, which seems fairly inflammatory, as I understand it, was introduced to show lack of cooperation with the police, although the video had nothing to do with the police. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know if it had nothing to do with the police. I think what the circumstances were was that Jordan Bentley, in his defense, got up and testified that he had been cooperative with the police. To impeach that testimony on rebuttal, the state offered the videotape. The videotape, I believe, is Mr. Bentley is leaving. I think it's the magistrate court, and there's a TV camera outside, and Bentley spits at the TV camera. And the argument was that, well, he's claiming that he's cooperative, but he's not really being cooperative. Now, that's, I guess, cooperative in a more generic sense. I mean, he's not there talking to a police officer. He's outside the court walking away when this happens. But I think it's at least of some relevance here as to whether he was a cooperative individual after his apprehension or not. And I think that's, you know, about as much as the tape was offered for. I mean, the jury had already heard at this point substantial testimony about him gunning this person down and in cold blood, shooting him repeatedly, fleeing from the authorities and being involved in high-speed chases. So I don't know that, you know, any error in allowing the videotape was anything other than harmless in this instance. Is there any other excuse me, questions? I'll try to answer those. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to clear up some of the questions about the record. At A104, the court states that he pulled up Ms. Creed's charges, and there was a trafficking charge of 10 to 50 grams. There were two possession with intent to deliver and cocaine, one possession with intent to deliver heroin. There was the weapons charge and conspiracy among those offenses.
Yeah, for those of us that are slightly removed from the Superior Court bench, pulled up means he had a computer.
He had a computer, and he looked on JIC to find that.
But we don't know from that the time reference for those charges.
Yeah, what it was indicated at A137, it looks like she was arrested on those offenses at on March 23rd of 06, and the discussion there was that everybody's understanding was that the offenses occurred sometime in March of 06. There's also at 104 through 116 discussion about the proposed questions that the attorney wanted to ask. That's also at 133 through 139. Ms. Dunkel, who was the attorney for Ms. Creed, agreed to very general questions that really did not help Mr. Bentley, in that he could ask her, do you know Joey? That did not go to the actual relationship. She posed any questioning about the sexual relationship. I'd also quickly state that it's not harmless error because this wasn't either the first issue or the videotape, because this was a credibility contest, and as the court has also mentioned, she was sort of the tiebreaker, Ms. Creed was, and Mr. Bentley testified, and with respect to the videotape, the extent that the jury felt bad about Mr. Bentley because he spit at an innocent person, that was significant. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.